Thank you, Phyllis. Took courage and effort. It was a nice presentation. Excuse me just a minute. Thursday will be Thanksgiving Day. I think we all know that. Lots of turkey, lots of football for many people. Not much thought as to why the U.S. is so great. They do not realize that God has selected us as Israel to be great. After Thanksgiving, we are in that period that's coming to be known by the name of Thanksgiving and culminates in Christmas. There's a long period. It used to be, you know, they didn't talk much about Christmas till the week before, but now we begin planning for Christmas before Thanksgiving is here. You've probably been watching the ads on TV. This is not Christmas, and it's not about Thanksgiving in one sense, but it's the introduction if you haven't discovered that yet. The day after Thanksgiving is coming to be known one of the biggest business days for retail merchants. It's the day that people begin shopping for Christmas gifts, and it's begun, it is now called Black Friday. That sounds awful, you know. Was it Black Friday that when the Great Depression started and the banks failed? Black something anyway. We now have Black Friday, and Lee was just telling me we're traveling either to or from Cambridge. So that it is known as Black Friday because the merchants are hoping they will sell so much that they will now be in the black rather than in the red. They will make money, and it will help them to have a profit this coming year. So it's based on the need for more money and selling more things. So for 4 weeks, there may be some good bargains you'll want to buy, so you'll be flocking with them too. For about 4 weeks, people will be flocking to the stores to buy something to give as a gift, something they would never wear themselves, but they figure someone else will want it. It may be some piece of cheap junk made in China, but it's all you can afford, and so you will be able to say that I gave them something for Christmas. And it will all be done on the alleged birthday of Jesus Christ, which culminates December 25th, when people gather around the Christmas tree and they look at each other and they look at the pictures of Jesus, then they swap gifts with each other on his birthday. Seems quite strange to do that, but that's the way it is. We are told that this season is the season for thoughtfulness, for love, and for giving, emphasis on giving. Or at least we're told that it is. And if it is a time of giving and thoughtfulness, why then is December 26th, the day after Christmas, the biggest gift return day of the whole year? They gave them something and the people don't want it. They don't like it. It's not what they envisioned, and now they're taking it back. Well, the answer to that question is simple. They didn't get what they wanted. They did not get what they wanted. Now, we don't know how many gifts are not returned, but they're just endured and placed on a shelf. We don't know how many there are like that. In one way or another, Christmas is another admixture of life. Admixture meaning it's a mixture of good and evil. It is good to give. But if it's allegedly the birthday of Jesus Christ and we're swapping gifts with each other, I think that's a slap in the face of Jesus Christ. Many people see through the mythology of Santa Claus. They recognize the commercialism of the season. They even know that. They even know that December 25 is not the birthday of Jesus. But the aspect of giving, or is it getting, seems to override all the errors of the season. They feel because it is done by everybody, compelled to give something to someone. Maybe they don't even really like them, but they feel compelled because it is the birthday of Jesus to give them something. And as I said, quite often it is taken back because it wasn't what the person wanted. Because of all of that, I think it's easy to see through the sham of Christmas, the admixture of good and evil. And because of that, it can be easy to blot out of our minds one of God's most wonderful and powerful principles. And it is a wonderful principle, and it is a very, very powerful principle. I'm not sure that even we in the Church of God fully believe in giving the way that God explains it in His Word. There are a couple of places, pretty hard to take sometimes when you read that, where it deals with the subject of giving to other people. We talk about the laws of God. We speak of keeping the laws of God. We call them living laws. But often we're doing that from the perspective of you will never be able to escape the negative consequences that come as a result of living contrary to the laws. Often years ago we said to the teenagers, look, you will suffer and suffer and suffer and suffer because you're doing that if you do that. It was all negative as far as the negative aspects of breaking the law. But on the other side of the coin, do we believe those laws are living laws, and that we cannot escape the good results if we live within those laws? And think about that for a little bit. How about giving? Is it one of God's laws? Or is it a term invented by preachers begging for more money from the people? Recently, I think it was on Yahoo page, there was a story about the pastor of that glass temple or crystal temple in Southern California, Schuller it is. Some short time ago, they had to declare bankruptcy. Money wasn't coming in. And on top of that, his wife has been ill in the bed some, and a message went out from Schuller's office to the parishioners asking them to please prepare food for his wife because they were in need of that. And if they would, then they would send a limo, mind you, a limo to pick up that food and take it back to the minister's wife. I don't know if any force was applied to make them do that or make them feel guilty, but I somehow think in my mind that they had a reservation about giving that food to the pastor's wife and having it taken to her by a limo when they had been declared bankrupt and now trying to get something from the people. So as I say, how about giving? Is it God's law? Or is it just a term invented by shysters to get away with asking for more money? What did Jesus say about giving? Do we know? And do we really believe what he said about giving? I'd like to look at two very pointed and powerful statements made by Jesus this afternoon. Well, he didn't make them this afternoon, but I'll give it to you this afternoon. One, we've read many, many times. It was stated to the elders of the church in Ephesus. You'll find this in Acts 20, beginning in verse 17. The Apostle Paul is talking to the elders, and then he quotes a statement that Jesus Christ made, and that's the point I want to come to. Acts chapter 20, and verse 17, is where Paul was not able to go to a certain place, and so he called the elders together. He had something he wanted to give to them. It says, from Miletus, he sent to Ephesus, he called for the elders, and then when they came, he began talking to them. In verse 28, he said, take heed to yourselves. He was giving them advice on what would happen to the church of God in the future and how they could deal with that. And also a little warning to them about hopefully they wouldn't be part of it. Take heed to yourselves, to all the flock among whom the Holy Spirit has made you overseers, to shepherd the church of God. Know how to be like a shepherd taking care of sheep. I don't care how much we may not like that term. God says we are sheep. Sheep are cute little critters, and they're very soft and nuzzly, but sometimes they're really dumb. And they can wander off and not even know they're wandering off until the wolf is there. And, then what do I do now? He said, I know this. Now, how he knew that, I don't know, but he said it. After I'm dead, savage wolves will enter in, and they won't spare the flock. Then he said, and also among yourselves, men will arise speaking perverse things, and the reason they'll do this is to draw away disciples for themselves. Now, why would they just want a group of people if there was no money in it? They did it to get the tithes and the offerings. Therefore, he said, therefore, watch. Then, skipping to, verse 35, getting close to the statement. Well, actually, he said in verse 34, he said, you yourselves know that these hands, Paul's hands, have provided for my necessities. You know, there were people that didn't like Paul, and they wouldn't give their tithe to him. So he didn't hold that against them. He worked himself at an outside job, and he paid for his wages. He took care of himself. And he didn't begrudge that. He wasn't feeling having a pity party here. He was just telling them that's the way it had been. I've provided for my necessities for those and for those who were with me. And I've shown you in every way by laboring like this that you must support the weak and remember the words of Jesus when he said, and here comes a quote from Jesus, it is more blessed to give than to receive or get, as Herbert Armstrong was famous for saying. Now notice, he did not say that it was wrong to receive. He didn't say that at all. Nothing wrong in deceiving. He said it is more blessed to give than it is to receive. So we need to learn to both give and to be able to receive. Now notice, he did not say at all that it is blessed in any way at all to take. He didn't say that. He just said it is more blessed to give than to receive. Now I notice it doesn't say here, and he didn't say this is one of God's laws. He merely said that it was more accommodating to life to give than it was to receive. So it's a quote of Jesus, I know, but is it just a fuzzy feel-good principle that we can take it or leave it? Some might feel that way. Well, I know he said that, but I don't see it that way. Well, let's look at another place where Jesus said something very specific in Luke 6 and verse 38, speaking, and I believe this was a part of the Sermon on the Mount. It's kind of differently laid out, but it has quite a lot of the same information that you'll find in Matthew 5, 6, and 7. So in Luke 6 and verse 38, Jesus said, give. Now, he didn't say money. He just said, give. It can be in money. It can be in time. It can be in thoughtfulness. It can be in many ways. But it's a matter of being thoughtful and helping someone in a certain way rather than taking from them. Give, and you'll wish you hadn't. Is that what he said? Give, and you'll be taken advantage of. Give, and you'll suffer financially, because they won't give it to you. So why should you give to them? He didn't put any qualifiers around it. He simply said, give. Give, and it shall return to you. Quite often we say, if I give this, I'm going to suffer because I'll have less than I had when I started. Which is true. Any fool can know that. Give, he said. Then he put emphasis on, and if we give, it will be given to you. Notice he said, good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over will be put into your bosom. Now that's a promise from Jesus. That's not Hargrove saying. That's not Herbert Armstrong. That's not any human being. That is Jesus, our Savior, our leader. Give, and it will be given. Now, he didn't say give everything you've got every day. It's a generic term. But it did involve the subject of giving as a thoughtful something toward other people. And he said it would be pretty nice, really, if you look at those other words, pressed down, shaken. And together. Have you ever bought recently we bought a huge container of whey protein. I thought, man, that's a big one. That'll last for a year. I opened it and it was halfway full. Why did they have to spend money for such a large plastic container then? Why didn't they just get a smaller one? They wanted you to think you were getting a bargain. But Jesus said it would be that you would have this big container and it would be full. Pressed down, given back in good measure, shaken together, running over, will it be put into your bosom? It sounds like it's reciprocal. If we give, it'll be, in one way or another, returned. Well, let's ask another question then. If that's true, and we believe it is because Jesus said it, if that's true, could it be true in reverse? If you don't give, ever, will it ever be given to you? If it's a law, and it's a living law, and it works on the positive, will it also work on the negative? You don't give, you don't believe in giving. I worked hard for this, I'm not giving it to anybody. Will we ever be given anything? Well, to answer that, I would suggest you ask your banker and ask him a question this way. If I open an account at your bank, but I don't put any money into the account, can I take money out of the account? What do you think his answer is going to be? You must be kidding. You think I'm an idiot? But that's the way some people think. I've opened this account with other people. I'm not going to put anything in it, but I'm going to be taking money out of the account. You know, I think we've done that with our children sometimes, even with our friends. If you never make a deposit, can you ever expect to take anything out? No, you shouldn't, but we do. We don't make deposits, but we want to take something out of it. That's like the man or woman, human being that doesn't understand it's 0 degrees outside. They have a stove inside the house. There's nothing in the stove. They're sitting in front of the stove and they say to the stove as if the stove could hear, you give me some heat first and then I'll put some wood in you. You see the logic? It doesn't work. It's a living law, positive or negatively. Jesus promised and emphasized the positive more than the negative because Jesus is positive and he wants us to be positive and he wants life to be good. So ask your banker and see what he says. It's a foregone conclusion. If we don't make any deposits, we cannot expect to make any withdrawals. So, what Jesus said is not just a fuzzy feel-good principle. It is an absolute living law. I think the ease of modern-day debt, credit as we call it, with a little small piece of plastic in our hand, has skewed our understanding of this reality. Excuse me. We have this piece of plastic in our hand. We don't have to make very much deposit, and we can get a lot if you got good credit. Until it finally catches up with us. No deposits, no withdrawals, no exceptions. With a little thought, we can see the absolute living law, truth, monetarily at least. But is it true in every other aspect of life? We can see it monetarily, but is it true in every other aspect of life? Well, I deliberately did not read the second half of verse 38, because it has a powerful principle here. Notice what Jesus said in the second half of 38. Now he said, give and. And the word for means because. Give and because with the same measure that you use, it will be measured back to you. Now, do we believe that? Is it a living law? I think people, and I've mentioned this before, but I'll mention it again today. We don't understand why people don't seem to respond to us properly as we think they should. And we don't realize that they are merely reflecting the attitude that we have given toward them. Some years ago, one of our sons started to ask me something, and then he stopped. And I said, well, what do you want, son? Oh, never mind. I said, no, what did you want? Well, nothing. I said, no, I know you wanted something. What was it? He said, oh, well, Dad, it wouldn't have made any difference anyway. You'd have said no anyway. That hit me right between the eyes. He had figured me out long ago. I was negative. And he was merely reflecting back to me what I had presented to him. It's reciprocal. Jesus said, if you give, then it will be returned to you in the same measure as you gave. That's a wonderful promise. I didn't say that. I'm merely reading to you what Jesus said. If you don't believe that, then you're missing out on life. Jesus seems to say that the results are in direct proportion to what we do. Well, what if that's true? What if that is true? Maybe we need to reread a few things and redo some of the things the way we do certain things. I've told this story before, but I'll modify it just a little this afternoon. I'd been in the ministry of Jesus Christ for nearly 30 years when this lesson began to dawn on me. In 91, the year we left Columbus, I began to realize, well, I think I need to make a study from the Bible about love. We talk a lot about love, and there are many different ideas of love in the world and in the church. So I went and got the concordance, and I began to look through the Bible chapter by chapter, verse by verse, sometimes word by word, when it came to the word love. You can find it all there with the concordance. And I came finally in the selections of the word love to Jeremiah 31, specifically verse 3. This was written from God through Jeremiah to Israel. And remember that at this time, Israel was in a very negative, hostile mode toward God. Israel had been promised that they would be the leading nation, that they would have a good life if they would follow God's laws. But they said, no, we don't want to. Ultimately, they said, no, we don't want to do that. We want to be like the Gentiles. We want their lifestyle. We want their religion. And they got it. So at this time, Israel had told God to get out of my life. I don't want to have anything to do with you. But he promised Abraham that he would take care of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob's children. So there it says, what we know reading historically, God said to Israel, you're the only nation I've ever loved. Now, not that he hated the others, but he said, Jacob I loved, Esau I hated, means loves less. He loved the other nations, but he didn't love them in the same way that he loved Israel, because he blessed Israel abundantly. He said, you're the only one I've ever loved. Therefore, I am going to draw you to me. Love is hard work. It's not just emotion. Love involves hard work. It's action, not just thought. Because Israel had gone away from God. God hadn't drawn them back yet, but he will. There's an important lesson here. God was the more mature person then and always. And so he knew he had to take the first step. That I think sometimes we're ignorant. I shouldn't say ignorant. We don't realize. And we say, well, I wish that person would change. And yet at the same time, we feel in our heart that we are more of a Christian than they are. We are more mature than they are. And so we, the more mature one, are waiting for the less mature one to take the first step. That doesn't make any sense. So the one who is the more mature must take the first step. And I realize that I was not close to my brothers and sisters because in late 56, I left home in Texas, went to Pasadena, California to attach myself to the Radio Church of God, and they took that as leaving the family, I guess, and at the same time, I didn't keep Christmas, I didn't keep the holidays, and I kept these strange sounding holy days to me, but weird days to them. And so there was a rift between me and them. And I caused it. They didn't cause it. I was the one that moved. I had pulled aside. And I'd been waiting for them to begin to compliment me and praise me. Never happened. Yet I professed to be the Christian. So I realized that I had to take the first step first. If it was going to be done, as they say, if it's going to be, it's up to me. I had to take the first step. It was my move first. So I did. I couldn't go to the holidays with them. So the one thing that I lit upon to do to help bring us closer together was because we never did keep birthdays as a family, and I don't remember ever getting a birthday card or any presents necessarily on a birthday, and I certainly hadn't given anybody else myself. So I decided to do that I would begin to send a very nice card, not just any card, but one I picked out with good words that I believed in, and send it to them, and I would put also in the envelope and the card a piece of green paper that had numbers on it, and Grant's number, and Grant's face, and Lincoln's face, and other faces that they knew. Money. They say money speaks, and in this case it did. I chose, first of all, a nephew who was almost my age. My older sister married at 14. So we kind of grew up as brothers in a sense. And I wrote out a $60 check and put it in the card and mailed it to him. Now, it says, with the same measure, it'll be measured. Often it takes time for this to happen, but the answer was almost immediate. The response was almost immediately. It took a couple of days to get there, and it took him a day or two to get over the bewilderment of why Vernon sent this. But he answered immediately. He phoned, and he said, "Do you know who this is?" And I said, "Sure, I knew it was. I could tell a Texas drawl when I heard it. And I knew who it was." He said, "You will never know how much that meant to me." And he repeated it. "You will never know how much that meant to me. I'm going to put that on my wall, and I'm never going to cash that check." And I've said to you before, I wish I'd have given him $100 or $200 then. For the accolades, maybe, but he never did cash it. He has not cashed it to this day. I've not seen it on the wall, but I trust he's got it somewhere. It did mean something to him. Now, the others wasn't as dramatic, but they did respond also. Gradually, over the years, they have responded. And they have complimented me, they have loved me, showed respect and honor. And in some ways, most all are dead. There's just an older sister now, she's 88, and I were the only two of the children. Mother and dad are dead. So, just this last week, she called, and she knows that my birthday is coming up soon. And she said, "What do you want for your birthday, $1 million? Well, she has money, but she doesn't have $1 million. I said, "No, just send me a card." And then I added, "And if you want, you could put a piece of green paper in it too." She said, "Well, I'll do that." Now, she's responding to things that Delia and I have done because in the last 2 or 3 years, we've gone to Texas, and she's a widow, has been for a few years, and we would take her with us when we visited some other part of the clan and pay for her food, pay for the motel, and she responded. She has been giving gifts, and she said, "I'll do that," and I'm sure she will. Until I moved, nothing happened. After I changed, they changed. And to a degree, they changed in direct proportion to what I had done. It took years, but it did happen. Recently, when I went back for the funeral of my oldest sister, his mother, the one I was talking about, I went over to his sister's home where we had lunch after the funeral, and got up to leave. I was going back home to Northwest Indiana or Ohio, I've forgotten which. And I went over, shook his hand. He shook my hand. And as I brought my hand out of his hand, I noticed I had something in my hand. And I looked at it. It was a $100 bill. And I said, "What is this?" He said, "I want you to have it. You drove all this way, 900 miles. I'd like for you to have it." I said, "Well, I don't need it." He said, "I know, but I want you to have it." So I took it, and it came from him. Also, it was either that time or one time before. He likes a little drink from time to time, and so I had a bottle of Scotch with me that Delia and I had bought in Scotland quite a few years before that. So I said, "You know, I'd like to drive around on your big pickup over this area where I used to live and see how things are." He said, "Well, I'll take you." So we drove for, I don't know, an hour, 2 or 3 hours, all the while sipping on a little Scotch. And he liked that. And he used to be very cynical, almost sarcastic to me about my religion. Not anymore. I had to take the first move, make the first move. And I'm not bragging about that, just saying that's what I did. You may do something else. But Jesus said, as you have given, it will be returned to you. Conversely, as you have not given, you're not going to get much unless they're trying to do the right thing. Let's look at a few other places now where there are underlying principles of these verses, and we need to analyze that and see if giving is involved. In Ephesians 5, Paul is talking to Ephesus. He suffered a lot in Ephesus. And so he was giving some instructions to, actually you could say he was counseling, but he's giving bottom line guidelines in dealing with people. He didn't write a book on it, but he gave the essence of the principle in dealing with certain individuals. And he mentioned something in Ephesians 5, verse 14 to begin with, where he said, well, verse 13, all things that are exposed are made manifest by the light. And if you can't see, you put a flashlight on it and you can tell what it is then. For whatever makes manifest is light. Then he says, therefore, in the light of all this, I've just said, awake, you who sleep. Now that's an analogy. Arise from the dead. Well, how many of you, if you died, could rise from the dead on your own? I couldn't. So it's an analogy of symbolically being asleep or in the grave, not really alert to what's going on. Awake, arise, and Christ will give you light. See then that you live circumspectly, not as fools, but as the wise, redeeming the time because the days are evil. And understand what God's will is. Then coming down to verse 21, he begins to talk to individual groups. And let's analyze what he said to see if perhaps the principle of giving first is involved in this principle. First of all, he said to all of them, submitting one to another. There are times when each of us has to show deference, and that's all submit means, to show deference to someone else who either has the right at that time or is more knowledgeable or more skilled. And we show deference to them and give honor to them in submitting to them because it's obvious they should take the lead. Then he dealt with the wife, or talked to the wives about being a wife. Wives, submit or show deference to your own husband as to the Lord. And I emphasize on in that we're all this way. Man is that way too. It's easy to flirtatiously chide with the opposite sex sometimes and do what, no evil in it, but your mate is sitting there saying, well, I wish you'd do that to me. Submit yourself to your own husband, because the husband is or is supposed to be the head of the wife as Christ is the head of the church. And I've often wondered, why in the world did God make us men to be the head? Because we have a lot to learn. And as the church is subject to Christ, let the wives be to their husbands. If you show deference to, or if you submit to, that shows that you are voluntarily showing thoughtfulness and giving to the husband those things that are needful in his life. What does a man want? Respect. He can't beat it out of you. It has to be given. And so if a woman shows respect, gives deference to, then it involves giving that respect. Surely there's something that could be respected that they could show that respect. Then on the other hand, in verse 25, it begins to talk to the husbands, the men. And as I said, this is not a full book about the subject, but it is the heart and core, the guts of the subject. And when you get to this, it solves a lot of things pretty quickly. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ loved the church. What does a woman want? She wants to know she's loved. It kills her if she believes she isn't. Can she make you love her? Well, she may can influence, but she can't make us. So the matter of giving love, expressing love, showing love is involved. As I said, giving, it's a generic term. It's not just about money. It's a living law of God. And notice it said we should do it as Jesus does to the church so that he could set it apart and cleanse it, that he might present it to himself, a glorious church. I suppose every man would want this beautiful young chick on his arm, you know, when Joe DiMaggio, he was getting up there in years, met Marilyn Monroe, he went crazy because he had this fame on his arm. God is doing that with us to be his wife. And he's giving us his word. He's giving us his spirit. He's giving us his strength. He's giving us his plan. He is presenting us to himself because he wants it that way. And it involves giving. And then in chapter 6, verse 1, he turns to the children. Sounds pretty rough here. Obey your parents. Shut up, kid, and do what I tell you. Well, you can get along that way for a while, but notice this does not say you have to do everything your parent tells you. What if your parent says, well, tell him a lie, just tell him I'm not here. And he knows you're asking him to lie. It says, obey your parents in the Lord. So you have a brain. You have to use your brain and determine who you're going to obey, God or them who's telling you to do what's wrong. But then it says, honor your father and your mother. Now, honor has to be given. And so even though you may not like your father and mother, or you may not believe all they say, still, as we use the expression, if you diss them, then you have to answer to God. Honor your father and mother. And it says it's the first commandment with promise, that there is a promise that a child will be blessed. It says it is a promise that it may be well with you and you may live long on the earth. So this involves giving honor. You may have to bite your lip, and you may have to control your words, but to express honor, who knows, it might have an effect on the parent toward you. Then to the fathers, the parents, do not provoke your children to anger or wrath. And in the days of Worldwide and Radio Church of God, when we were in great authority, we did provoke our children to wrath at times. Instead, it says, bring up the children in the old King James in the nourishment. The nourishment has connection with food, nourishing food. You really enjoy nourishing food. You can eat a plateful of it in a hurry. It's so delicious and tasteful, and it makes you feel good. Nourishing and then admonishing when you see need to admonish. Well, this shows that we are to, as parents, to express or give proper compliments and proper admonishment when needed, but nourishment is first, and they may change toward us. Then it says, bondservants are slaves. Yes, there were human beings who were slaves in the church of God, and their owner was in the church also. That's different than in modern day America, but that was the way it was. Slaves, bondservants, be obedient to those who are your masters according to the flesh, and do it as if they were Jesus Christ. So you have to give honor and respect and a full day's work and a little less lip you have to give. And he said, don't do it with eye service as men pleasers. Do it because you want to do God's will. And then notice verse 8 again, speaking to the slave, this principle, knowing that whatever good anyone does, he will receive the same from God, whether he's a slave or a free person. God is not prejudiced. And you masters, slave owners or bosses, do the same thing to them, giving up threatening, knowing that you have a boss in heaven and there's no partiality with him. He may lay it on you. So all the while here, this seemed like commands, but you will see that the word give is involved in this. I said, do we fully understand as members of God's church the overall emphasis, or I should say the overall goodness of the word give as a living law rather than take, waiting for someone to give to us first? In each of these cases, each had to make the first move, and it involved the principle of giving to the individuals what they needed. What do you think would have happened if those people had done exactly opposite to the guidelines Paul gave? Well, I'll give you three guesses, and the first two don't count. It wouldn't work, because if we don't give, we don't receive. Living law or feel-good sermon material, which is it? Well, I'll say from personal experience that you'll never know till you've tried it both ways and you're convinced of the results of your actions. And I put myself there too. You will find that God explains it very, very clearly. We've read over it many times, but often it is mere words. And because we have drifted so far from the dirt, the soil, the earth, the farm, it sounds like religion, and we don't see the reality of it. And that's in Galatians 6, where Paul, in verse 4, again states a most wonderful and powerful principle. Galatians 6 and verse 4. No, just a minute. Oh, no wonder I was in 4 verse 6. I wanted 6 verse 4. Galatians 6 verse 4 says, let each individual examine his own work. Am I doing it right? Am I doing it wrong? Then we'll have rejoicing in ourselves alone and not in somebody else. And notice it said, each individual shall bear his or her own load. I can't relieve you of your load. You can't relieve me of mine. Don't be deceived, in verse 7. God is not mocked. That sounds so religious, but he's trying to get across an important principle. And it is, whatever an individual sows, that's what he's going to reap. in the matter of farming or gardening, the soil, I say lifeless, it isn't lifeless, but from the human perspective, it's an inert, lifeless something. And the soil doesn't care what you put in it. And it doesn't matter. Whatever is put in it, it will produce from it. Whether it's good or whether it's poisonous. For instance, if you have a plot of land and you dig two little holes, and in it you put a vegetable that's good and it'll give you good health, in the one hole, and you put in the next hole, you put some horribly poisonous piece of vegetation, cover them both up. As I said, the soil doesn't care what you put in it, but it'll bring it up. It'll produce it. And that's the way it is with us and our minds. The mind is lifeless in one sense, though it really isn't. But whatever you put into your mind, that's what's going to be produced. Because Jesus said, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. So we do have to be careful what we plant. Because what we plant grows in our life. What we put in comes out in proportion to what we put in. It is such an absolute law, and it's a wonderful law, and I think we should look at it positively. Positively. We have often used that principle, speaking to teenagers, "Oh, you kids, you're really going to suffer because of what you're doing." Well, that's true, they do, but that's the negative side. But on the positive side, if they live by the positive aspect of this law, they will reap wonderful rewards in life. Always. Because it is a living law. Some have seen that, some have not. There is one other aspect of this in let's see, Luke 6, verse 34. This one is the tricky one, and it's hard to acknowledge this is our attitude. Luke 6 and verse 34. About giving. If you lend, which is giving, or loan, and when you get a loan, the bank is giving you some money. So this could be written to the banker. But if we're doing it similarly, if you lend to those from whom you hope to receive back. Now you say, well, what's wrong with that? It's my money. Well, in a sense, there's nothing wrong with it. But if that's the reason and the only reason you're doing it, it's selfish. If you're not doing it to help them, they may know that, and it won't mean much to them. So if you lend to those whom you hope to receive back, what credit is that to you? You are you are like the men of the West who tracked down a thief or a murderer to get the reward. That was all they had in it. They wanted something for themselves. They're giving so they could get something back. So our attitude is very, very important, that we're not just, we don't want to just, we should have the attitude of being wanting to help also. Now, that doesn't mean that we have to be taken advantage of, because whether you like it or not or believe it or not, there are those even in the Church of God who can always have their hand out. And they have not learned a lesson also on this. And in a sense, they would be eligible for Exodus 21, verse 1, which says, if you buy a Hebrew slave. Now, you didn't buy them, in a sense. You took them over for 7 years, and they worked free of charge, learning how to manage their life. It was a wonderful law, and it made the weakest link of Israel strong. The weakest link was strong because of that, of giving. And when they left, it said, don't turn them out with nothing. You take care of them when they leave because they gave to you for 7 years. What we sow, we reap. As we give, it comes back to us. Some might say, well, that sounds like the law of attraction, and we've proved that to be wrong. People are, you know, Oprah was great on that law of attraction. Well, there are a lot of them that take this and misuse it. So some might say, well, it just cannot be that simple. I can't see how it could be that simple. Well, you can grow mad trying to understand it, but the only way you're ever going to know is if you do it. If you do it. Because if you got $20 and you give away three, you only got 17 left. Anybody knows you're $3 in the hole right there. So how could you have more? Well, you have to have faith in God that He will do what He promised. It is a living law. Don't try to figure it out. Just accept it. There are a couple maybe. In Proverbs 11, verse 24, logically, this one doesn't make any sense at all, but notice what it says in Proverbs 11 and verse 24. There is one who scatters, meaning gives away what he has, yet increases more. Now, how can you do that if you scatter what you have that you have more? And there is one who withholds more than is appropriate, but it leads to poverty. You say, well, that's mine. I can hold it if I want it. That's true. But money wasn't made just to hoard. It was to help yourself and others under your umbrella. So, scatter, increase. Not give, diminish. Doesn't make any sense, does it? But it's one of God's living laws. Now, there are two other factors involved in this that is essential in our learning this lesson. One is, it takes time. It takes time. It is not going to happen instantaneously. Now, in my nephew's case, it was pretty close, maybe 4 days after I mailed the letter. But that's still not instantaneously. It took a little while. I wondered if he even got it. I wondered if he would respond, but he did. It took years to work on my family. And I'm glad I did because I love them. I said I love them, but I never showed it until then that much because I knew the truth and they didn't. The second is the amount is not that important. It really isn't. It's the principle involved. If we learn the principle, it'll work for any amount. Some people say, well, if I had $1 million, I could be generous. Well, maybe. But I think it's a little harder if you have $1 million to give $900,000 as a gift than if you got $100 and you give $25. Because, you know, you say, well, I don't have much anyway. Not going to do much good. I may as well give it. Maybe God will bless me. The amount is not that important. Let's look in 11, verse 41. Luke 11. I don't think there's a chapter. I don't think there's a book called 11, is there? Luke 11 and verse 41. Give alms, which is charity, of such things as you have. God does not expect us to give what we don't have. But, you know, you've heard some preachers say, give till it hurts. Maybe, maybe not. If that's what you want to do, fine. God doesn't demand everything unless it's a certain one. Now, there was that rich man. And he was asked to give all that he had, but he was offered a job with Jesus. And how much does he... He didn't know the honor and the privileges and the blessing he would have. He didn't consider that. He just said, I'm not going to give up my money. And he said no to Jesus. So it says, give alms of such things as you have. Then, indeed, all things are clean to you. You know, you got peace of mind. It's our money. We give when, how much, to whom, as we choose. And our mind is at ease. We're following the principle. Well, we have about 4 more weeks of watching people buying gifts to exchange on the birthday of Jesus, to exchange it with each other. And they're celebrating the birthday of Jesus. It would be easy to get turned off with Christmas. Let's hope it will not turn us off on giving. Because that's a living, loving law of God. Giving is an integral part of being a Christian. You cannot separate Christianity from giving. It's one of the basic ways in which we become like God, because he gives us his word, he gives us his spirit, he gives us blessings. Look what he gave to Abraham. Look what we have because of what God gave us. So remember the words of Jesus. Give, and you'll be taken advantage of. No, remember the words of Jesus. Give, and it'll be given to you. With the same measure that you give, it'll be given back to you. So maybe we can think a little bit about this during these upcoming 4 weeks, about what Jesus said, that giving, money, other things, is a living law of God.